From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made with an email. In October 2015, Yale University's Intercultural Affairs Committee sent an email to all students advising them to, quote, culturally unaware or insensitive choices, that those weren't allowed with their Halloween costumes. Lecturer Erica Christakis disagreed with that approach and sent her own email to students on campus. Her message acknowledged concerns about cultural appropriation and personal representation, but she accused the administration of attempting to censor students, and she pushed them to make their own decisions about what they wore, to shape their own norms. That email led to a firestorm on campus, which in turn erupted into a national debate about free speech, microaggressions, student welfare and trauma, and academic freedom. Christakis and her husband, Yale professor Nicholas Christakis, resigned from their posts. Meanwhile, similar situations were happening at other schools, Princeton, Oberlin, and Emerson. Playwright Ellen Burgess, a Yale graduate herself, was listening to these conversations. In fact, she said she went down a rabbit hole reading student statements, professor op-eds, and alumni comments. She says she noticed people weren't really listening to each other and they didn't agree about fundamental facts in American history. Within a month, she had penned the first draft of a play called The Niceties. Loosely based on that Yale incident, that fictional story offers a window into the lives of a white American history professor, and a driven Black student who is writing a paper about the American Revolution. What begins as a conversation about grammar and Google becomes a fiery debate over race and social justice in America, both past and present. The Niceties has been described as explosive, and having seen it last night, I have to agree. It's on stage at Geva Theater Center now through November 17th. On this hour, the team behind the production joins me to talk about the impact this provocative work may have, who controls the narrative when it comes to history, and the role of discomfort when it comes to examining our own lives and privilege. I'd like to welcome my guests for the hour. We have a lot to talk about, Mark Cuddy, right?
Yes, indeed.
He's the artistic director of Geva Theater Center, and he's celebrating 25 seasons this year. Welcome back to the program, and congratulations.
Yeah, thanks, Megan.
Also in studio, Cindy De La Cruz, an actor who plays Zoe Reed in The Niceties. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Jordan Baker is here, an actor who plays Janine Bosco in The Niceties. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Nicole A. Watson is the director of The Niceties. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Before we were on air today, we were having a brief conversation about the reaction that audiences have had to the performance, Mark. And I know that as the artistic director, as the producer of the performance, you want audiences to have a good experience, maybe an experience that takes them out of their comfort zone. We'll talk a lot about that. But what's the feedback that you've been hearing? What have you been noticing so far?
Right. So we've had two preview performances, and the ride, because it's like you're on this journey and on this ride, and it's sort of a buckle up, here we go. And there are vocal responses throughout the entire performance of reactions. It's almost like a mystery as it unfolds, because it's a complex debate, and things are said that perhaps are often thought but not expressed out loud, and those are getting all sorts of reactions, and the actors and director could talk about that. But it's fantastic, because it's an unusual experience in the theater. You know, there's you think of the title, The Niceties, and Rochester's a very nice community with a lot of nice people, and it's an experience that sort of shakes people up, not in a bad way, in a sort of wonderful way, because it's unexpected.
And we'll talk a lot about that unexpectedness this hour. I'm so glad to be able to talk about this play for an hour. I wish we had more time, because as I sat there throughout the performance, I thought we could do a whole day on this. There are so many issues, so many important topics to discuss. And that's leading me into a conversation about how important public radio is to our audience. Not a great transition, I know, but we have an hour to discuss these important subjects. That's only happening here at WXXI. I'd like to bring in my colleague Rob Braden very quickly to talk about an important time here at WXXI.
Thanks, Megan. Great transition.
I'm working on it.
That's right. What it takes to put together a show like this is amazing. Not only do we have an amazing producer like Megan Mack, probably the best in the whole Northeast.
Oh, Rob.
We have a great host and journalist, Evan Dawson, And I'm on the boards here, but also behind me is a whole team of engineers that bring you broadcast radio through all of the antennas and the gear downstairs. Also, the IT engineers that also live help us live stream these shows to you and help bring you these important topics dealing with race and politics and everything in the local community needs to hear in a rare show like this. And you can help pitch in by calling 454-6300, or you can go to WXXINews.org. That's 454-6300, WXXINews.org. And also, there's a dollar-for-dollar challenge. David and Ann Still, members since 1995, David is our vice chair of the BOT, will gladly match every dollar. Again, that's 454-6300, WXXINews.org. Thanks.
Thank you, Rob. Rob does great work on our board every single day here at WXXI. And as he said, the team here is working together every day to bring important conversations to air, especially important conversations like this, where we can talk about the history of race in America and the current state of race relations in America. And going back to that discomfort that we mentioned before, Mark, Jeeva's talked about race relations before in different plays. I think this play takes that issue to a different level. And again, that word explosive, I think, is a fair description. Did your team at Jeeva consider this play a risk in any way for your audience?
No, you know, we've been going for many years with topical issues. And first of all, the play has to be a really good play. It has to be really well written and be theatrical and not just a polemic. So we thought the theatricality of this, of pitting these two very smart, very driven women in this situation would really be very sparky and spark a lot of conversation. And I think this one also sparks a lot of thought, a lot of reflection afterwards. And there's a lot to take away.
I think that's definitely true. I was telling the team here before we were on the air that when my friend and I stepped out into the lobby during intermission, it was very quiet. People were having quieter conversations. I think they looked like they were reflective. My friend and I certainly were having conversations. And I did notice that, to put a general percentage on the audience, I think maybe 98% of the audience last night was white. And as white people, I think the issues that are raised in the play give us a lot to think about. Nicole, when you're looking at the script and you take it to the stage, what is your goal with challenging the audience?
You know, I mean, I think my goal as a director is to always do the play. And with a play like this, I will say just personally, I did my undergrad at Yale. I was a history major and a history teacher before I became a director. So for me, like, the work of this play was making sure that both arguments were heard, that both women were heard, because it's not my job to pick a side. And truthfully, I don't want anyone who watches the play to pick one side. The play is there to provoke conversation. So I think my personal background, my desire to have conversations about our history, like, I love history and I am keenly aware about how much I did not learn until I chose to study history, and not everyone is a history major. So I love that this play allows two amazingly talented women to play amazingly fierce and strong women who have very strong feelings and opinions about our past and its implications for our present.
I'll turn to the actors now. This is a new play for Rochester. I know it's been on stage in different cities across the country. And what drew you to these characters? These are, I think, difficult roles, and you can speak more to that. But to be on stage for that amount of time, just the two of you, having really a debate for 2 hours, what drew you to the role, Cindy?
I mean, these are things that I deal with, that friends of mine deal with. It's very current. The play is set in 2016, but we're still going through the same problems. So, yeah, that's really what drew me. I just, I wanted to have this conversation, and I wanted to explore this debate. I mean, as an actor, this is challenging, especially because we have so much language that we're using. A lot of the language that I say I don't use on a normal basis. it's challenging for me as an individual and as an actor. And Jordan's just a pleasure to be on stage with.
Thank you.
Jordan, what drew you to the role?
You know, it's so interesting you're asking that question, because I think that was a question that Nicole actually asked me when we first met. And I said, you know, when I first read it, I had never seen the play performed. I know that it had been done around. I think it was just the idea of this really bright person who could not see their own ignorance. And yet, at the same time, I think what I say to Cindy's character all the time is, you know, history is created by flawed, imperfect people. And while she knows that about others, she cannot see that in herself. And our own racism within ourselves, that we think we're really good, liberal people, and we just don't see the microaggressions that are going on. I know I'm of a certain age, and I sometimes don't know when I'm saying something and I have to get up to speed again. So something about that appealed to me. Also, the language on this play is really dense, and a challenge, the challenge of learning it and carving the speeches in a way that breaks all that down so you hear the story is a great challenge for the actor.
We can talk more about that language during the hour. I don't want to give away too much of the plot for our listeners who plan to see it. It's on stage through November 17th, and you can get tickets on Jeeva's website. But let's just do a brief overview about the character. So as we continue our conversation this hour, our listeners have a chance to understand them a little better. So Cindy, you play Zoe Reed. She's a student at a prestigious university. Tell us a little bit about Zoe.
Zoe's very driven. She is an excellent student. She's very good at what she does, and she's very passionate about what she believes in. She is an activist. I think I can say that, right?
Yeah.
She's an activist, and she really believes in what she's fighting for, whether it be papers or protesting. She fights for what she wants and what she believes the world can be.
On some level, I don't want to interrupt, but like there are like examples that make me think that she's one of those like model students, in the sense that she seems to be interrogating everything.
Yeah.
You know, that
yeah.
thing of you get to school and there are no adults and all of a sudden everything is a new idea. So, you know, even the function of the college is a thing on the table, you know, and I just love that the mind is so big with ideas, you know, and which is why she can just spar with her professor in such a big way, too. Sorry
and
to interrupt.
No, please do. And Jordan, your character, Janine, is very well respected at this institution. She's just completed writing the first draft of her book.
Another book. Second book.
Oh, I didn't mean to denigrate
her.
No,
it's okay. Yeah, she's one of the foremost scholars in this particular course is on revolutions. She is, Congress calls her, the State Department calls her for information. She's incredibly bright. She comes from not a wealthy background. Her mother cleaned houses in Zoe's neighborhood. but because of her education and because of her knowledge, because she's worked so hard to be better than everybody else, she's sort of become this improved version of something. So I think it's kind of shocking. There's some spoilers about me, which I can't talk about on the radio, which come up in the second act. But yeah, you know, and she comes from a Polish background, which does influence a lot of things about her sense of fight, and where that she tries to use to even the score a little bit about the history of African Americans, and Polish uses that a bit in the play. It's just so interesting to watch someone of stature lose their footing, to have to own their weaknesses in their thinking and in their character.
And that happens in multiple ways, I think, throughout the performance. Again, we don't want to give up too much of the plot, but I do want to talk about Zoe's paper. So Zoe comes into Professor Bosco's office to talk about a paper that she's writing about the American Revolution and if it was or was not successful in varying degrees. So I think that'll help us characterize the rest of the conversation, because at the heart of it, this play is about who controls the narrative, who writes history. And there's a beautiful display in Jeeva's lobby about decolonization, that if you get to the performance, listeners, take a few moments to stop in the lobby and read the digital sign with all of that information. It's very important. I actually heard from a local history professor at the college level who reached out to us and said, I'm taking my students to see this play. It's so important because they don't know what they didn't learn in high school. So there's a lot going on. So let's talk about that paper for a moment, Cindy. What is her thesis?
So her thesis is that the American Revolution was only possible because of the existence of slavery. She truly believes this, she believes that she's not getting enough information from her classes. So she kind of just comes up with this theory on her own, and she looks for sources. That's part of the debate, where she gets these sources from and who gets to tell these stories. I mean, when you think about slavery, I mean, a lot of these people couldn't write, they couldn't read. It's a power thing, right? You don't want someone to be, if they know how to read or write, they're liberated, right? So, that's part of the debate between me and Janine, is that she really wants me to find solid sources for this thesis. But, I mean, there isn't much because, you know, they couldn't write, they couldn't read, they had no money.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of that large display in the lobby. There's nothing available. Those voices were silenced. And when you look at the modern education system, this Eurocentric curricula that I'm sure many of us experienced, I went to public school. I did not learn about redlining until I was an adult. I'm embarrassed to say that. There are other instances I could think of that I learned about when I was post-college even, and I thought to myself, why did I never learn about that in school? And like you said, Nicole, maybe if you're not a history major, you're not pursuing that subject, you're not delving into the subjects that we all should be learning. And I just want, if you were able to change the system, Nicole, if you could go back and take a look at 21st century curricula, I don't want to have you create a bullet point list of what you'd like to see, but what are some of the major issues that you would talk to administrators about?
Well, first thing I'd do is I'd have more arts in schools. Because I fundamentally, one of the reasons why I moved back into theater and stopped teaching was that theater and the performing arts give you the opportunity to show point of view, multiple stories, perspective. Plays can do something in a night that it'll take me a week to do in a classroom. So the first thing I'd say is more arts in school. But if I could have any say over the curriculum, I think we need a more honest conversation about, as Zoe says, the bad parts of American history. And my question to people is always like, what will it cost you to learn something that you didn't know? What is the cost to all of us to have a more honest conversation that our founding fathers, while extremely bright and great military tacticians and very intellectual people, were also slave owners, also didn't believe that their wives or their daughters should have any rights, did not believe that indigenous people should have land? Like, what is the cost to have both those stories? And for me, because I, again, as a lover of history and just also like a lover of the country that I live in, like I don't find a cost in it. I've learned terrible things, but it doesn't make me feel some negative way about my neighbors. I just think we all need to know this. So I would say like we just need a more complete story. We do need a more inclusive story. I think we have to learn how to, on some level, navigate our feelings about things with the knowledge. Like, you know, again, for me, I always say, I mean, and I still read lots of history books, and I say, while I am always learning, no book will ever be enough to explain why we're terrible to one another. You know, like, it happens. So my heart will never accept it, but my brain can read all the reasons why we do these things. And I guess I'm just interested in how we further our conversations. Probably means less tests, probably means less Scantrons, less less belief that we all have to know the same five things. You know, the world is vast, our history is vast, and every year there's more and more to teach. So I don't know, get someone to talk to me and I'll plan a curriculum.
Somebody in this community is going to take you up on that offer. How many teachers of color did you have in K through 12, Nicole?
I had a math teacher in fifth grade. And my senior year, there was one male African-American history professor. That might have been it.
Mark, how about you? How many teachers of color did you have, K through 12?
Well, the nuns were all white for my first sixth grades. And then in 7 through 12, I went to a combined school, and maybe three or four teachers of color. Often they were teaching languages like Spanish, or, you know, that sort of thing.
Cindy, how about you?
One math teacher in high school, and one Latino teacher in fifth grade.
Two. Jordan?
What an extraordinary question. I have gone to so many educational institutions, and I'm sitting here thinking back, so I'm going to say that I grew up in Los Angeles, public school first, all white. Then I went to private school, all white. Then I went back to public school, all white. When I moved to New York, started studying acting, no one. And then I went to three colleges, no one.
Even in college?
I'm a graduate of Smith College and Rutgers University. And I would say, and there's no teacher that I can point to that was a person of color.
Yeah. My first African-American female teacher was a teaching assistant my second semester of freshman year at Yale. That was the first time there was a woman like me who was smart and made me major in history.
I ask this question not to, well, no, I do want to be critical of communities, because it's an issue raised in the play. It's about representation. And when you have students who don't see teachers who look like them, you can ask the question, do they know that those professions are accessible to them? Can they aspire to higher education? We did a series here a few years ago called Degrees of Diversity, where we studied that issue for a year and found that a number of local school districts, I don't have the names off the top of my head, but a handful of them had zero teachers of color, a handful had one teacher of color. Since that time, some of these districts have started incorporating more books by authors of color to help improve their curricula and related issues. Perhaps that will happen with history curricula someday. I hope so. But unless we talk about all of these things and bring them out into the open, as this play successfully does, I think, we're not making much change. And change is another key word in the performance that I saw last night, because there are conversations about what is the best approach to enacting change that the two characters have. And we can talk about that in our second half hour of the program. We'll take our short break. Listeners, if you'd like to join the conversation, the number here is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. If you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email the program at connections@wxxi.org, and you can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. Short break, more connections next. Coming up in our second hour, we're joined by Governor Andrew Cuomo. He's on the program to discuss updates with the Ready Commission. He was in Rochester yesterday announcing that the state has awarded more than $130 million to more than 60 projects across the Lake Ontario shoreline. That funding will be used to rebuild those areas. We'll talk about his goals for that and the impact that lake flooding has had on the state's economy. Governor Andrew Cuomo, next. This is Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking about a play on the Jeeva stage called The Niceties. And it's an explosive look at race relations in America, at history curricula, at what's going on college campuses. There's a lot to tackle there. And I highly recommend, listeners, that you find an opportunity to see this performance. You'll find that perhaps you'll leave the room being very reflective, thinking about your own experiences, not only in school, but in life. If you have certain kinds of privilege and how they fit into your life today, I think many of us have privilege that we should be better at recognizing. And that play really helps us see that, I think. So we're sitting down with Mark Cuddy, the artistic director of Jeeva Theater Center. He's celebrating 25 seasons this year. Welcome back to him and congratulations. Can't say that enough, Mark. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. I was just a child when I started.
Cindy Dela Cruz plays Zoe Reed in The Niceties. Jordan Baker plays Janine Bosco in The Niceties, the professor. And Nicole Watson is the director. We're having a conversation about a number of issues, and I'd like to talk about the role of activists. Zoe describes herself in the play as an activist, and there's a conversation that she and her professor have about what's the most effective way to create change. And they approach that question in different ways. And whether it's public pressure, Jordan, your character has a line about yelling doesn't create mm-hmm. change. Let's talk a little bit about their different approaches, and then I'd like to throw some questions your way about that. So how does Zoe think that change is effective?
I truly believe that Zoe feels that gradualism is not the answer, that if you want something to change, you got to go out there and fight for it. So she's just all about really going out and demanding change, which I love. I mean, you know, not a lot of us have the courage to do that, right? Because of different things, whether it be jobs or school or what the media might say. And now, you know, social media, you know, everyone knows what you're doing all the time. So it's, you know, it takes a lot of courage to do what Zoe does. But she truly, truly believes in if you want to see change, you got to go out and you got to fight for it. You got to demand it. There is no other way.
Mm-hmm. And Jordan, Janine approaches it in a bit different of a way, some of it based on her own experiences as an activist mm-hmm. when she was younger. But what is her approach?
Very different from Zoe, that's for sure. I think about the context of sort of what's going on in our world right now with there's so many revolutions going on right now at just the lowest level where people are getting a tax increase of just 20%, 20 cents, you know, and they're burning down the building. What Janine, when she looks at that, is that you have to have a majority. She is a deep, passionate believer in democracy and the idea that we have the right as a group to have our say. I understand that from, forgive me, your That's child, okay. the child perspective, is that if you don't have the voice, then we should just burn the house down. But that Janine believes in community building, and that if you really believe in democracy, then you must believe that you need to get the majority on your side. And how do you do that? You do that through patience and tolerance and community building and playing nice, even when you don't want to. And there's a gradual approach over time where change can happen. However, from a personal perspective, the things that I see going on right now, which I have never seen in my lifetime, when people don't have a voice, when they're too poor and too downtrodden, they will burn the house down. I see it happening.
We've had conversations on this program about the burden that people of color have to carry when we're having conversations like that. Something that Zoe talks about in the play. Mm-hmm. And Nicole, I want to ask you about the responsibility when it comes to education. We've had some guests on this program, women of color, who have said, it is not our responsibility to educate white people about racism. We've had other African-American women who've said, we want to educate people. So white people about racism, it's subjective. I understand that. How do you feel about that question?
I mean, I imagine that, like, we get to pick. I don't feel that it's my responsibility to educate everybody. I certainly shouldn't do it by myself, but I'm a teacher. I'm an artist. I do this work as a form of having conversation. But I also want to make sure that the conversations I am engaging in are respectful, are honest, are with people who I think want to listen. You know, I think everybody has to choose how they're going to fight, you know, and who you will fight for. You know, I sometimes think about in my own work, yes, I can fight racism and I can have these conversations. I can also spend my time celebrating the people I love and their work. So for me, I want to do both. But I do believe that this, we all need to learn. And I think it's important also that white people share knowledge with their neighbors as they learn. If I'm not welcome in your house, if I'm not welcome in your neighborhood, I don't know how to teach you. I don't know how to have a conversation with you. So I just think we all have work to do, and I think different people will choose how they will engage in this work. And we have to, I think, respect both points of view because not everybody can do everything, you know. So you pick how you're going to do it.
Cindy, how do you feel about that question?
Kind of the same way. I mean, it's hard, you know. It's emotionally exhausting to try to make someone see the humanity in you. But at the same time, I do educate people that I love. If I love you, I will let you know that you hurt me or that someone that you're with hurt me. you know, but I'm not going to pick a fight with a guy on the subway yelling at me, you know, he can, whatever. But, you know, but I, yeah, but it, I pick and choose because it's also about my self-preservation, right? I got to take care of myself because it's not just, I mean, it's a constant overload between what I'm hearing, what's going on in D.C., what's going on in my community, what's going on in New York City or New York as a whole. I mean, it's a lot. So not every day I have the power, the strength to educate everybody. You know, so I'm, especially now in my life, in this point in my life, I'm learning how to pick and choose my battles because not every battle needs to be fought. Sometimes I need to think about how I'm going to phrase what I'm going to say and you know, decide whether I want to educate that person and if it's okay, if I will be okay after the conversation.
Yeah, there was, and I haven't finished reading it, so I feel a little like I'm speaking out of turn, but there's this Toni Morrison essay that I've been reading, and, you know, she sort of she talks about, like, having to always be fighting against racism is a kind of distraction, and it really keeps you from doing other things that are important for your own life, and I think that is, I think a lot about that, you know, that if all I'm doing is trying to convince someone who doesn't respect me to respect me, that's a lot of extra work, and there's a whole lot of other things I'm not doing, you know? So I think it's why I think you pick and choose, but, you know, like working on this play and then having audiences come see this play, it is a way to share ideas and have conversations. And this is a way to do it that is completely wonderful and, you know, and exciting and full of joy, so, yeah.
Are you hopeful? Are you hopeful about the future?
That's a tough question.
I want to be, but I think, and I'll let other people speak, but hope is an action. I don't think it's a lofty idea. It is a thing that has to be manifested in our actions. So it's there. It's just, we are hope.
Mm-hmm. Cindy, what do you think? Are you hopeful about the future?
I'm hopeful. In my generation, I feel like people are waking up to things. So I am hopeful for change. I am hopeful that the spread of information, the way that it has been for me as a, you know, from a child to now, has allowed people to really see the humanity in other people and to start conversations that maybe we wouldn't have had before because someone, you know, lives in Kansas and you live in New York. So how would you connect? But yeah, I am a bit hopeful. But at the same time, just like Nicole was saying, it's action is so important. But I do feel like my generation is really taking action into their own hands. They're really, really saying enough is enough. And that makes me hopeful, seeing my friends and my colleagues just really demand respect, demand inclusion. That keeps me hopeful on a daily basis.
Mark and Jordan, the changes that you've seen over the past few decades when it comes to activism, do you find this generation is different than generations you've seen before?
Goodness, I grew up during the Vietnam War, so. And in Los Angeles, we were burning down the house. I think one of the most interesting things I've found so far is the social media, particularly Twitter, because I'm able to see things that young people are posting, particularly the Twitter feeds that I see about the abuses of Black people throughout the country with law enforcement and in other ways that I normally would never see that on the news. That would not be part of my conscious story. I don't personally do well with violence. I don't even watch movies that way. But it's there in front of me pretty consistently that young people keep posting this, that the protections of people keeping cameras on in their cars so we can, in real time, start to really see really, really, really what is going on, which is a little bit different, I think, than what I knew when I was young growing up. So I know, I guess that's how it's affecting my opinion as I look around. I'm really horrified. In terms of the hope question, I might just step back
on
that
a
second. Because what came to me was, you know, my hope came from my elders who could talk about a time that was as devastating for them that they lived through. And because they lived through it, I was hopeful that, okay, things will get better because it got better for them. So I have, you know, grandparents that lived through the Depression, you know, and things like that. And my elders are all gone. I am now the elder. So when you ask a question like hope, the one thing I keep saying to myself during this particular time in our country is that what a beautiful thing democracy is, because there will be change. Change is forced every 4 years, every 2 years in some cases for other positions. But because our leadership has the ability to change, that is my hope, that I will try to keep everybody protected through a tough time, but that there will be change, and I do believe it will be positive change at the end of the day. I believe as Americans, we're good people. At heart, we're good people, and that this chaos will end, and that it will get better.
Mm-hmm. Mark, what do you think? Are you seeing differences in this generation?
Define this generation.
I'd say millennials. I know that term comes with a little disgruntlement.
Not those people. Cindy, do I see her? Yeah, I have a 31-year-old and a 24-year-old son, and they're actually different generations, and they have different views about hope. Not to bring what they believe into this program, but there are certainly boundaries that have been broken down and blurred. In young people, I would say, in teenagers and people in their 20s, that about, you know, some old ways of viewing other people. I mean, there is a much more acceptance, much more inclusion with just that I've seen in terms of young people being with other people, that they don't judge them. There's just less judging. Around the bubble that I live in, which is a bubble, and you know, to get to the hope question, we've had lots of discussion internally as we're planning our 2021 season about what audiences need right now, not about particular plays, but just what's the temperature, and it's going to be a wild year next year because of the presidential election, and you know, the word hope has come up a lot. There are very different ways of expressing hope, and hope is change, is transformation, it's not just, oh, everything turns out all right. That's not hope. There are many ways of expressing what is hope. But I think in the theater, which is basically, I try to find these stories that relate to people every year. It's a safe place to feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. It's a safe place to be with people who have chosen themselves. No one ordered them to do it. Like they're gathering because they want to be there. And they want to have 2 hours of something that's different than what they're experiencing outside. Why would you go to the theater if you're just going to see the same thing that you're seeing outside? There has to be something transformational. There have to be multiple perspectives, as Nicole has said. There has to be a way to see human beings do what they do. I mean, history is just what human beings have done, right? So the humanity that you see on stage when you go to see a play or a musical helps you kind of understand why things happen. It's because they're people. And sometimes they're acting horribly. But you have that perspective. So I have hope for the theater, is that we can continue to be able to tell our stories and have audiences experience the wide range of emotions and thoughts and feelings.
When Variety reviewed this script, they wrote, quote, "Burgess's timely script doesn't shy away from such difficult truths, but it raises them strategically, fully aware that the theater is primarily an arena for the privileged and that one cannot be too confrontational toward those who are paying more than $100 a ticket, end quote. The tickets are not more than $100.
Thank you. They're not.
They are not. That is a review of a different show in a different part of the country. But it sounds, Mark, that you disagree with that statement. Do you feel like this play could have been more confrontational, or do you think it was provocative enough for?
Oh, they're a different play. No, that's an unfair question because every play is different.
I guess I should say the script.
The script. That's what I'm talking about. There are fantastically confrontational plays. Several of them are happening right now in New York City. But that's a different play. It's a different experience. I think this one is so well written, and it's a full experience. And it's, you know, not every play can represent everything.
Do you mean different iterations of this script? Is that?
I'm just saying play will provide a different experience. And so, is it privileged? Yes, because you do pay a ticket. It's not, you know, open forum, and you have to actually buy a ticket to come to see a show. So you are curated in that way, but is it a full experience? Sure, it's just different than other plays.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question from a listener named Susan. She says, in the intro to today's show, I believe the director said that The Niceties does not take sides. But then one of the actors said she found the play interesting because although one of the characters is very intelligent, she is blind to her own racism. So which is it? Does the play portray one side as racist, or does it leave that up to the audience? I'll turn that over to Nicole.
I mean, I don't think the fact that one of the characters is discovering her own blind spots means that there's a side in the play. I think that these two women are presenting their arguments. And again, for me, or some other director could direct this play and make one person right and one person wrong. I am not interested in that, nor do I think the script that I don't know what conversation you have if I made the play so unbalanced. And I think Jordan's in for Janine is so astute because that's why I like Jordan gives an amazing performance of Janine. It's that she's willing to say this woman does not know things in spite of all the things she knows. And it's also why artists are amazing. We always, I think, are willing to admit that we don't know things because we're on a lifelong journey of learning. So I don't quite know how to answer that question.
I can answer it easily and just say
sides
are not taken in this play. It goes back and forth. We're both right. We're both wrong. Yeah. We're both glorious. We're both disgusting. We're both kind of, it just goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I think that's why I've been saying in several other radio interviews that if you're a member of a group, maybe the Rotary Club or a book club or a religious organization, come as a group.
Yeah.
Because the lobby, it's very interesting to me that you got a quiet lobby, meaning maybe people didn't feel free to express some of the things that might be going through their head.
It seemed reflective to me. Okay. I wouldn't say that people were
tempered.
Afraid. I think they just were really thinking about what they saw.
I would love people to come in their groups and be exposed to this and then go out in that lobby intermission and after, because we know we have a lot of people who are talking days later still having discussion on the play.
Yeah.
But to have you come with your group and really go at it. Yeah. What is your side? Mm. Do you have a side?
Yeah.
Because we don't really, it's not in the play. It's not.
No. I agree with Jordan totally. I mean, my character, you know, she has her beliefs, but at the same time, we're only human. I mean, we're not perfect. We make mistakes. We say things we shouldn't say. You know, we act from impulse. I mean, that doesn't make a person right or wrong. It just makes a person human. So you're just seeing two human beings, two women particularly, just having a conversation, having a debate about something. It's not... We're just, there is no right or wrong. I mean, I think that would be so uninteresting to watch.
I think that's the conversation. And I think what's interesting about the play is it can reveal the things you already think. You know, you can tell when the audience is like, oh, yes, I believe that. And then they switch and they go, oh, I believe that, too. It reveals what you already think about certain ideas as well as presenting new ones. And, you know, I always say in rehearsal, there are moments when I go, I was that teacher. Then I go, I was that student. And, I, you know, like for me, just as a director, it would have been so not interesting if I had tried to direct this play to say one of these women was right and the other was wrong. That totally would rob our audiences of this experience.
Bonnie in Rochester says racism needs to be dealt with in multiple ways in educational programs. And I think theater is absolutely one way, as you said, Nicole, to handle that. And Bonnie's a regular caller to this program and is very involved in different community efforts in that regard. And I think that raising that issue in multiple ways is important. And what would you like to see, Cindy, outside of the theater, either in classrooms or in communities? Like, what would be the next thing that you would like to see in terms of education?
Definitely more variety in what we learn. I am first generation American. I am of Dominican descent. I didn't learn anything about anything to do with Dominican people, and New York City has the largest Dominican population outside of the Dominican Republic. How is that possible? You know, I think it's important for schools to look at the communities that they're serving and to serve those communities and those children, because, you know, I would go home and I would learn things from my parents, but when I went to school, I would learn, you know, Eurocentric things. And so it was this imbalance where it was like I was only allowed to talk about my heritage and things I wanted to learn at home and not at school, when, I mean, school should be the place where, you know, teachers are inspiring their students to think critically and to teach them about things that they would have otherwise not known. You know, so yeah, I definitely think it's important for schools to serve the communities that they're educating. I mean, you got to look at your populations and say, okay, we have 50% of the students are Haitian. We should do a semester or a section on Haitian history. I mean, it's not that hard. I mean, we have Google, we have, you know, YouTube, we have books, we have all these things that are at our disposal. I mean, why not use that? And why not enrich the lives of these children? I mean, teach them that they have history outside of what we say history is, you know?
Well, the Niceties is on stage at Jiva through November 17th. So listeners, if you're interested in reflecting on some of the topics that we talked about, try to find a time to get to see this performance. It is powerful. It's remarkable. I enjoyed it. So thank you to the women and the team behind this. And Mark, this is the second performance in Jiva's current season, the 2019 to 2020 season. And what's coming up next?
Right. So we're in rehearsals for a play in the Fielding Stage, which is the smaller of the two theaters, of a play by Mathri Shekhar called Queen. And it's about two women PhD students who are working to develop a paper over years and years and years studying queen bees, studying the bee population and the decimation of the bee population and how it affects American ecology. And they are focused on the Monsanto pesticides as being the culprit. And they're about to publish a huge article in Nature magazine. And at the very last survey in the field, they came up with some different results that kind of skews their findings, and they have an ethical decision to make about whether, because they believe in their hearts that they are right, but some of the data doesn't actually show that now. So it's a fantastic, and it's, you know, all about relationships, and there's a little bit of romance in there, and there's a comedy, and it's a terrific piece of theater. So I encourage everyone to do that and to come see us in the small stage.
Mm-hmm. Slow Food is on the docket this year.
That's our comedy in January, because I love to produce a comedy in January because it's January in Rochester. And then I'm directing the Irish musical Once, which is based on the film. And that goes over to Syracuse after it runs here. We have a comedy in the in the Fielding after that called Cry It Out, which is about new mothers and new babies. Cry It Out. Then we're doing a world premiere that is set in the Kodak Labs in 1963 called Looks Like Pretty. And it's a commission that we gave out for this story about the Shirley card and about how Kodak film color technique was developed based on this young Caucasian girl named Shirley. And so how that has changed photography.
And many other things. And many more. You can find them all on Jeeva's website. In 15 seconds, Mark, I know this is probably an unfair question, but you're celebrating 25 seasons as the artistic director. What has been the greatest joy for you?
The audience that goes with us year to year. It's the consistency and the willing to engage over 24 years of great discussions on stage and off.
Thank you. Thank you for your work in the community. Thank you to the entire team here from the Niceties. Cindy Dela Cruz, Jordan Baker, Nicole Watson, and Mark Cuddy. Thank you for being here. Thanks for sharing these important messages.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Short break, listeners, and Governor Cuomo is next.